Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 94 for March 29th, 2011. My name is Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Ramier.
I'm David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
And we've got three stories for you this week, and a week that was kind of rampant with tech stories. We had a tough time choosing just three to bring to you. So they are, in order of appearance, the AT&T and T-Mobile merger. Second, Apple suing Amazon over the App Store trademark. And finally, a New York District Court federal judge put the kibosh on the Google Book settlement. So we're going to talk about that. Starting off, we've got the AT&T mobile merger. This made big story, big news, because AT&T proposed to buy T-Mobile for, specifically the T-Mobile United States division, for $39 billion, making AT&T basically, well, it would, if this goes through, which is far from a done deal, it would make AT&T the largest mobile carrier in the United States, with, you know, something along the lines of 40%+ of the market. It would make them the only major GSM provider in the United States, and as a result, it would make them pretty much the only provider for people visiting abroad, because GSM is also is the most prevalent standard used elsewhere in the world. Why it's often called the world phone. So we posted a little bit about this, just talking about one of the considerations that's going to go into this, as far as whether or not the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission are going to try to block this merger. So before we dive into this, does anybody have, you know, visceral reactions to this, whether or not they think it's a good idea, bad idea, whether or not they think it's going to go through?
So I just wanted to point out, I pulled some numbers from The Economist. Right now, the largest mobile provider is Verizon with 31% of the mobile market. AT&T has 27%. T-Mobile has 12, and Sprint has 12, with the rest having 18%. So that means that with AT&T and T-Mobile combined, that would give them 39, bigger than Verizon's 31. Just so you have a ballpark of what sort of numbers we're talking about here.
Is anybody else surprised that 18% of mobile phones are on some network other than Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, or Sprint?
I was trying to find out what those were. And I really have no idea.
Yeah, and I guess my kind of piggyback question to that is, why are we counting? I imagine a bunch of these are on virtual mobile network operators, people like Boost and Virgin, which don't have their own networks, but just piggyback on one of the other networks. I think most of them piggyback off of Sprint. Why aren't we considering those Sprint customers for the purposes of... Or maybe we will consider them Sprint customers for the purpose of the ultimate market analysis. So I guess the first thing I want to do is talk a little bit about what kind of regulatory hoops AT&T and T-Mobile are going to have to go through if they actually want this merger to go through. First of all, there's going to be they're going to have to get clearance from the Federal Communications Commission. And there was a bunch of talk in AT&T's announcement. They were saying how great this deal was going to be for people in rural America, because this deal was going to allow AT&T to bring 4G wireless to areas, you know, something like 95% of Americans, and in areas that would not have otherwise gotten 4G. And those statements were probably targeted toward the FCC to get FCC's approval, because the FCC, as we've discussed before, is in charge of pretty much all of the broadcast and wireless traffic in the United States. And they're going to have to grant AT&T, they're going to have to approve the transfer of T-Mobile's licenses for wireless spectrum to AT&T. The other two big regulatory bodies from which AT&T and T-Mobile are going to have to get permission are the Federal Trade Commission, which is mainly a regulatory agency, and the Department of Justice. Now, in 2010, the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission promulgated new guidelines for horizontal mergers, and horizontal mergers are mergers of people who compete in the same market, as opposed to a vertical merger, which is two people down the supply chain. So A vertical merger would be if, AT&T merged with Nokia. So now AT&T was providing the service, the handset, or, if they also merged with, some sort of person who made, I don't know, internet backbone or, everything that you need to do to get wireless service to a customer. So as I was saying, the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, 37-page document that we'll make available on our website that basically goes through what the DOJ and FTC are going to look at when they're deciding whether or not to file a suit to block a merger. And one of these things, and the thing I think at least that they're most concerned about is whether or not the new merged entity is going to have an inordinate amount of market power. And I went through this calculation on the website. They use something called the HHI index, which I'm not going to try to pronounce live on the podcast. They are German names and they are difficult to pronounce. It basically you take the market share of each company, the percentage market share of each company, square it, and then add it together, and you get a number. In concentrated markets, the number is usually somewhere in the 1500s to 2000s. In highly concentrated markets, it's over 2500. And what I was showing on the website is using at least the numbers that I found, and they come close to lining up with the ones that David Liu just said. This merger would turn the mobile carrier market from what's now a moderately concentrated market to a highly concentrated market, where there are only a few major competitors and then a bunch of lesser competitors that, in this case, are either virtual competitors because they don't have their own networks, or they are local networks. And there are apparently lots and lots and lots of little local carriers that I'm not very familiar with, but they do exist. So, I've been talking for a little while now. Anybody want to join in? What do we think the likely effect is going to be on the market for mobile carriers? Well, on the market for a mobile service, cell phone service, as a result of this merger?
Well, it would seem that you would have less choice since there's more concentration in the market. As a consumer, I mean, of course.
Right, and will AT&T, do you think that AT&T, as a result of there being generally less choice, is going to be able to leverage that into higher prices? Which, in the end, is
Possibly.
what I think the DOJ and the FTC are most concerned about. And, you have to wonder, are they're going to be concerning themselves with both higher prices for the consumers and, or, lower prices for handset makers. It is AT&T, as the GSM purchaser, going to be able to leverage that into getting a deal, or essentially being anti-competitive with the people who manufacture these handsets?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, and I think you're right. That's exactly what these regulatory agencies are concerned about, whether they're AT&T or AT&T and T-Mobile will now have some ability to manipulate the pricing schemes. It seems that the two companies are sort of touting this as an opportunity for cost savings, and that's sort of interesting to me because the market is fairly static. If you look at your options between carriers, there, unless you're looking at a grandfathered in types of service plans where you might have lower pricing and unlimited data and the like, a lot of the plans seem very similar between the carriers. And not only that, I think something that drives a lot of people's consumers' decision making when they're looking to get a new cell phone service plan with a new carrier is that in smaller areas that are outside the major metropolitan areas, sometimes you're really limited just to one or two carriers because of service coverage, especially in the middle of in the middle of nowhere where there aren't any cell towers up.
Right, but going back to a moment to the more major metropolitan areas where you do have this competition, one of the things that the DOJ and the FTC are going to be looking at is what types of effective, rather, how easy it is to switch from one network to another. Because if one network is a good substitute for another network, if Verizon or Sprint is a good substitute for T-Mobile, and there isn't a huge cost to switch to that, then AT&T is going to lose some of their power as being a, not a monopolist, but having a large market presence. They're going to lose some of that power if you can just switch to another operator. And with the exception of them being the largest in principle GSM provider, it's pretty easy to switch from GSM to CDMA. You got to get a new handset, you may have to pay an early termination fee, but is the ease of switching from one provider to another, is that going to outweigh whatever market power they gain?
What do you mean? Why would the ease of switching outweigh market power?
It would weigh against market power because if you can switch to an alternative to AT&T, Verizon being a very good alternative to AT&T, then AT&T doesn't have pricing power.
I see what you're saying.
Right. And like I was saying, the DOJ and the FTC are concerned with this power in the market to dictate the prices. And, if AT&T wants to charge $800 for a iPhone, I can just go to Verizon. If they want to charge, $120 for a data plan, I can go to Sprint or Verizon. They will have some power. The question is, are they going to gain enough power by being so large or by being the only GSM provider that it's going to have an anti-competitive effect?
Well, I mean, looking at the market, the HHI index going to highly concentrated, that doesn't really bode well to me.
Yeah, and it doesn't bode well for AT&T either, because assuming the DOJ crunches the numbers the same way I did, that's going to mean that there's actually an actual presumption of market power that AT&T is going to have to rebut in any type of legal proceeding. So, where normally the DOJ is going to have the burden of going out there and saying, "Listen, we're going to have to prove that there's an anti-competitive increase in market power because you've hit this threshold of turning the market from moderately concentrated to highly concentrated." There's going to be that presumption, and it's on you, AT&T, to rebut that presumption, to produce sufficient evidence to show that you're not going to have an increase in market power. Moving on to the more practical impacts of this. Has anyone heard somebody other than a shill for AT&T or T-Mobile who seems to think that this is a good idea?
I
Well,
think it's generally limited to people who have stock in those two companies.
mean, looking at it from a rather disinterested perspective, T-Mobile really has been struggling lately, and this is something that they probably need, just because they don't have any of the big flagship handsets. Their network isn't particularly amazing. Verizon got the iPhone; they didn't. Sprint is sort of in the same sort of situation. There's AT&T and Verizon, and then there's Sprint and T-Mobile.
That's an
They're
interesting
having a
point you
hard time
bring.
competing. Go ahead.
Right, that's an interesting point though, because if a company is, essentially on the verge of bankruptcy, the DOJ will take a look at this and say, "Well, yes, you're going to have a likely increase in market power. It may not be great for consumers, but because we're saving, this merger will save a company from the brink of bankruptcy, we'll look past that." I don't think that either T-Mobile or Sprint are quite there. Yes, they're not doing well, but I don't think they're doing so poorly that they'd be able to, use that as a mitigating factor against the merger. David Liu, you started to say something?
I mean, I'm not completely convinced that T-Mobile is that much on the brink. I mean, the first thing that came to mind when I was thinking about T-Mobile when I heard this news was the incessant ads that have come out lately of T-Mobile attacking AT&T, with the, basically a parody of the Apple commercials where you have a woman shilling for T-Mobile comparing herself to the iPhone and saying, "Oh, we're much faster," and that sort of thing. So, not only is there that aspect to it, but the fact that T-Mobile has had a decent partner in Google for recent history, in that, Android has been one of the major networks that it's been on has been T-Mobile, and Google has had that nice partnership with T-Mobile recently. So with T-Mobile being absorbed by AT&T, you can imagine things getting harder for Google. There's also a number of other things in addition to the just pure market share that I think sort of don't bode well for this. And these are things specific to T-Mobile that I was reading about, you know, things like the fact that generally T-Mobile has been one of the cheaper providers and have offered things like Wi-Fi calling that the other providers don't necessarily have. And there was also something that came up on Reddit, which was that T-Mobile was the only one of the only cellular companies that did not participate in warrantless surveillance through NSA programs. So, you know, there's a couple things specific to T-Mobile that I would be sad to see go if it gets rolled into AT&T.
Isn't the plan for the companies to be operating under separate brand names for a little bit and then before they merge?
All I heard was that, you know, they're not going to be merged for at least a year. And, you know, I could have told you that before it was announced because there's still a lot of regulatory hurdles to go through. So it's not like tomorrow, you know, everything's going to be AT&T. But yes. So in answer to your question, yes, there's going to be a period of time before the companies merge.
These are all business companies, too. It takes quite a bit of time to combine two companies, and really this is more of an acquisition. This is AT&T is going to consume T-Mobile, at least from how I understand the proposed agreement.
Yeah, and Gadget has this cute little graphic of the AT&T logo eating the T-Mobile logo. Question about the stock deal, like the legality of that. $39 billion, is that conditional on the deal getting approved? Like, how does that actually work with regulation?
Yeah, it would be. There's... I don't know the details of securities regulation, but there's, from what I heard, something like a $3 billion kill fee. So if the deal is not approved by regulators, T-Mobile is still going to get $3 billion, either $3 billion in stock or $3 billion in cash, or, you know, some $3 billion one way or another. The $39 billion is obviously not going to be issued in any way until the deal goes through.
Okay, that makes sense.
This is obviously something that we're going to follow very closely. Any last thoughts before we move on?
All set here.
My last thought was just about one concern that some people had brought up was that this is likely to go through, at least in terms of the current president, just in that as much as he controls it, the one of his major pushes of his presidency has been to try to increase the amount of broadband access. And at least the way that AT&T is spinning this, that would help that cause. So,
yeah, it's also been his job. Well, it's also been a hallmark of his presidency that the DOJ has tightened its guidelines for mergers, as opposed to under the previous administration, where there is a systemic loosening of guidelines for mergers. So, you know, there are really two competing forces here. There's the FCC side of it, where we're increasing broadband access, and there's the merger side of it, where we're decreasing competition.
Predictions from our panel, how this is going to work out? Or go ahead.
I was actually just going to say that it's too early to tell thus far. We'll have a better idea perhaps in a few months, or as we actually hear some responses from some of these regulatory agencies.
Right, and my thought is if AT&T and T-Mobile want it to go through, they will agree to tons and tons of terms and conditions to make it go through. But my guess is it will either... Yeah, I really don't know. They may agree, make enough concessions for it to go through, but my guess is they would want to have fewer concessions rather than more.
That makes sense. If that's it on that story, let's move to our next one, which is Apple suing Amazon.com, saying that the Amazon App Store, no space, infringes Apple's trademark for the App Store with a space and the store capitalized. Amazon recently launched its App Store, one word, Amazon's, for Android-based devices to basically serve as an alternative to the Android marketplace so that people could purchase Android apps through Amazon's App Store. This is part of the nature of the Android platform, that there isn't just one App Store, I guess, or one marketplace. Amazon is free to start their own. And Apple has a trademark on App Store, and is saying that Amazon's App Store infringes that trademark. Thoughts from the panel on how this is going to go down, considering that Microsoft has already said that they're opposing Apple's App Store registration in the first place. So this is sort of another conflict.
I'd like to hear Ben's thoughts first.
I was just about to chime in, so that's fine. It's not an easy call. So I think in the public, and this is, you know, my upstate, or rather New England liberal, app lover, Apple fanboy perspective, there's a strong association between the word app and Apple as a provider of apps and iPhones and the service through which you get apps. That being said, the word app itself has been around for a long time, used to describe applications in a colloquial way. So I really don't know if Apple has enough secondary meaning in the phrase App Store to trademark it. It's a tough call on it's a tough call for me. I don't think other people either on this panel or generally have as difficult a time thinking that it's Apple would not have the rights in the term App Store. But you know, the iPhone and the iPod Touch and the software that goes along with that are so prevalent, and the term App Store and so much advertising has gone into associating App Store with Apple and the iPhone. I mean, you got to wonder whether or not they can produce studies or, surveys that can show that people have an association between the phrase App Store and Apple Computer.
I think there is, in fact, an app for that.
For the surveys? Or are you making a joke on...
I was making a joke just because one of Apple's primary advertising slogans for a while was, there's an app for that. And so I think that's among the places where app has been popularized.
And they've also trademarked that slogan.
The problem to me is that there's only so many ways that you can describe an app store. And it seems that every major platform provider out there, whether it's Android or whether it's these new sort of third-party Android app stores that have popped up, there's only so many ways you could describe those things. Are they digital e-commerce portals for software that would be used on smartphones, or are they app stores? Frankly, I hear everybody refer to the software that goes on to smartphones as apps, whether it's an Android platform or whether we're talking about iOS. And it's just commonly associated with loading that software onto the phones. It doesn't seem to be platform dependent in any way. And the term store by itself is just very descriptive. It describes a place that you buy things. So if you sort of put those two words together, I don't know that you have a really hard time getting away from the descriptive nature of both of them.
Didn't Apple disclaim store in their application? I seem to remember.
Individually.
So I went to the most scientific way to figure out who should own this trademark, and the Wikipedia page for App Store is primarily about the Apple App Store. And then at the very end, it lists a number of different similar services, and they are all combinations of the brand name, the word app, and something like store, marketplace, shop, or catalog. So you have the app catalog for Palm, the Android market, the Windows marketplace, and things along those lines.
Windows 7 has apps?
The Windows marketplace for mobile, so yeah.
That's a mouthful.
You sure it's not the Windows Phone 7 series marketplace for mobile applications? Because that sounds more Microsoft-like.
Service. You need to work service into that.
Yeah, Wikipedia actually has a page on this called The List of Digital Distribution Platforms for Mobile Devices. And it has nice table here, which has the name of every store for every platform. And among the interesting ones, yeah, I think we have App Catalog, like you mentioned, David, App World, which is the BlackBerry one, and then the Ovi store, which is a Nokia one.
I mean, I think we can agree that app is in itself not a trademarkable term, right? And store in itself is not a trademarkable term. It's the combination that is what we're really
Well, it
looking at
depends on
here.
what context they're being used in, but again, I'll generally. So the term app to describe an application is not trademarkable, and the term store to describe a store is not trademarkable. But the question
Yes.
is, can Apple use app to describe a marketplace and have that be trademarkable?
A digital distribution platform.
Yes.
Is it really something so different though? If you have a fruit stand and you're selling fruit at it, you want to call it a fruit store, and you try to trademark fruit store, you're going to get laughed out. There's no way that's going to fly.
Right. I don't disagree with you on any particular point, except for the fact that if you were the first fruit store around, and you spent a great deal of time and money marketing fruit store, and then somebody comes along and also calls their store where they sell produce a fruit store, you're probably going to be pissed.
Well, no, I think this is entirely a consequence of the novelty of the technology area, basically. Had apps been around for years and the idea of selling them, like you said, it's the sort of first come to market. And their name is honestly a lot better sounding than any of their competitors.
Right,
With
Apple's
the exception
certainly
of the Amazon App Store.
Yes.
Apple has certainly popularized the term app. I will give them that. But I did look it up the other day on the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, and I think the first use was in 1985 or so.
I mean, it comes naturally from application. It's just a shortening.
Although I'm kind of curious, do we think that Apple's affinity towards the word app has anything to do with the fact that it is Apple?
I don't think
Could
so.
be, but I don't think that it's necessarily on purpose.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's raised in a brief somewhere along the line, but I don't think that that's where they're hanging their hat.
Assuming that Amazon comes back and challenges the validity of the mark and does so on the basis of descriptiveness, I think this is a very hard suit, or very hard, that would be a very hard challenge for Apple to defend.
I enjoy the story just because it does tie into my minor interest in stories that we'd cover in Technically Legal that revolve around trademarking parts of words. So, app, the various stories we've had about Facebook and using half of that trademark to describe websites. And the one that struck me in regards to this story, though, was the word pod and the fact that everybody talks about podcasting. And that's been used so much and so generally that it has, even though, I mean, this is a podcast and that refers specifically originally to the iPod. So I could easily see Apple losing a hold of this, like the pod prefix, and ending up where app does universally describe these sort of mobile applications.
Well, all it
I don't
takes, though,
know.
is at some point to get secondary meaning. The trademarks are all about identifying the source of goods or services. And if at some point in time people come to associate the term app exclusively with Apple, or more often than not with Apple, then they could get protection for it. But up until then, they don't have any.
So what's the next step here? How is this lawsuit going to resolve along with Microsoft's
We talked a little bit about this on the email chain. So, well, Microsoft filed an opposition in the trademark office. So that's going to be resolved in the trademark office, and if necessary, with an appeal to either the federal, to either one of the federal district courts or federal appeals court. I don't remember off the top of my head if there's an option or if it automatically goes to one of the two. In this case, we were talking about this on an email thread. I don't know if Apple can, in good faith, settle this in any way that doesn't involve Amazon changing the name of their app store to something else. They may have to fight this out, and if that happens, we're going to see Amazon file a 12b6 motion to dismiss. Then we're going to see discovery motions for summary judgment. Then possibly a trial and post-verdict motions or appeals.
Do you, just quick survey of the panel, predictions on how this is going to pan out? Is Apple going to walk away with the App Store?
It's so hard to say because then you have some issues of fact that will need to be resolved by the court, and In the past, how I've seen some of these things resolved is that they do the surveys of the public and they try to determine what people think when they hear a particular term, and it's supposed to be an objective survey, so it's not like you're just going to the Apple fanboys and asking them what they think when they hear the term app.
And those are pretty much uniformly destroyed by judges. I've never seen a judge in an opinion go like, this was a great survey, it was totally balanced and fairly done. So it's very difficult to prove a case with surveys, at least from what I've seen. Which, by the way, is why it's easier to prove a case once you have a registered trademark, as opposed to proving it on a common law trademark, which, if Apple isn't granted the registration, is what they will have to do here.
Well, I'm going to actually answer the question and say that App Store will become a general term and not exclusively Apple. That's just my prediction.
I hear it used that way a lot in just everyday encounters with people when they refer to either the Android marketplace or to the App Store, and they seem to do so indiscriminately. And I've seen it done a lot by the Apple folks. They say, "Oh, on your Android, go to your Android-based phone, go to your App Store, and then you can go download this app. I'm sure it's there." And they don't really seem to care one way or another.
I predict that Apple will retain App Store.
And Ben?
I'm leaning toward Dominic's view that Apple's going to win, but it's like I said before, it's a tough call.
All right, well, on that note, are we ready to move to our third and final story?
Believe so.
Okay, and this brings us to the Google Book settlement, and this is a case that has been kicking around for almost 6 or 7 years now. There's quite a bit of detail to it. There's quite a bit of detail to the settlement agreement. I'm going to try to give a quick rundown on that. And I think it might even be best for us to focus just on what exactly this means and what happened and what the settlement agreement was, and then we can sort of toss in our 2 cents where appropriate. So the story, though, is that this week the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York rejected the latest version of the Google Books settlement. This was, of course, the product of an effort to settle over the last 5 years. The case has been going on a little bit longer than that. A little background on Google Books. It was introduced in 2004, and very simply, it's a search service that searches the full text of books, which have been scanned into a storage database by Google using optical character recognition technology. That basically means that we're not talking about image scans, we're talking about the text actually being searchable. And as of about late 2010 in the fall, they had scanned in about 15 million books into the system. And when they originally announced this project back in 2004, they said that they were going to be scanning in books that were in the public domain and books that are still under the protection of copyright. And it took less than a year for a class action lawsuit to be filed against Google, claiming, of course, that Google was violating copyright with respect to the books that were still under copyright and that they owed royalties to all the rights owners. Eventually, a number of parties joined the litigation. It includes the 5 largest publishers in the United States, along with several trade groups and effectively all the authors of every book known, all known and unknown authors of every book ever written. So it's also important to note exactly how Google Books works. And when you search for something and you get a hit in Google Books, if the work is still under copyright and it's not in the public domain, then Google is just providing little snippets of the results, which kind of just shows you a few pages at a time. And this is sort of the basis of what Google believes is ultimately a fair use of the works. Because they're not actually providing the entire text to users, then they believe that they're not actually violating copyright. But the biggest problem for this case, though, turns out to be this thing called orphan works. Now, an orphan work is a text where the book's author or the rights owner can't be found or isn't known. There are a lot of these books. This has apparently been a problem for quite a long time. Unfortunately, publishing companies, they are acquired by larger publishing companies. They dissolve in bankruptcy, and some of them don't even keep very good records about who the authors were. So if you consider that there's somewhere around the range of 120 million books that have been published in all of time, you can consider that, you know, most people are probably only aware of a small number of books that are well known, but there is a huge dearth of books beneath that that are just weren't popular for one reason or another, or got lost over the years, and along with that, the rights are unclear. It's unclear who owns the rights. It might be unclear who the actual author is. So in 2006, just about a year after the suit began, the parties tried to settle, and they eventually came up with the first iteration of a proposed settlement. And under this agreement, Google was going to pay $125 million, $45 million of which would go to the rights holders themselves, $15 million to the publisher's legal fees, $30 million to the author's attorneys, $34 million to create something called a book rights registry. And that would be a website where, sort of like a clearinghouse, where you could go in and collect royalty payments from Google and send them out, and Google would be sending money out through this website to the individual authors that they would owe money to. And in exchange for all of this, Google would be released from copyright liability. It's kind of like a, if you think about it in the broad sense, it's a sharing scheme for Google splitting its revenue of the books that it had scanned in. And of course, Google is making money from the framing of, with ads and stuff. It would be splitting those revenues with the rights owners of those books as they came up. When you have a large class action lawsuit like this, any settlement agreement has to be approved by the judge in the case. And so the judge was looking particularly at some of these issues that were raised by, there were something like 500 complaints about the proposed settlement agreement that had been filed. The biggest of which, though, dealt with these orphan works. The orphan works, basically, under the way that this agreement was going to work, all authors, whether they were known or unknown, would be affected by the settlement if it eventually went through. And so that meant that there were a bunch of orphan works authors out there who were, they wouldn't have an opportunity to negotiate part of the settlement on their behalf. So under the terms of the settlement, though, the way that the settlement tried to fix this, if an orphan work author eventually became known or resurfaced, he or she would be bound by the terms of the settlement agreement, meaning that they could not sue Google for the use that Google had made of the work. But instead, they could then opt out of the Google settlement agreement, and they could collect all the revenues they were owed up to that point, and that was it. And this seems to be one of the biggest problems that the judge found with this. In particular, this sort of usurps the Copyright Act a bit, because you have parties that are trying to settle a case, and they're settling rights on behalf of folks who are not actually arguing for themselves and haven't agreed to the terms of this. And the DOJ had actually filed its own complaints, raising some antitrust concerns, saying that under the terms of this agreement, Google is going to be allowed to continue to scan in books. And so that would effectively grant Google some kind of or something akin to a monopoly for digital books. There were also some privacy concerns, although the judge didn't really seem to buy into them too much, but I think the biggest problem was the orphan works and the fact that the settlement agreement was, by default, it was all known and unknown authors. And he suggested in his concluding thoughts that maybe if they changed the settlement agreement so that it was all authors would have to opt into it, that might be one way to solve the problem. Another way might be taking this to Congress and getting them to modify the Copyright Act. So, thoughts from the panel?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind if the settlement was changed to be an opt-in, so everyone is automatically out of it unless they decide to be part of it, but then, you know, it kind of takes the teeth out of, you know, the settlement. It's not really a settlement anymore. It's a new optional program that Google has instated, and it doesn't actually do anything to resolve the class action, because you still have all of these people who were wronged by Google and, you know, combined their forces to try to rectify that.
This is maybe even a much larger problem that I'm letting on. It's so expensive to scan in these books page by page. They have, in the process of this project, I think Google has acquired a bunch of new technology in order to make the scanning process faster and more accurate. You're basically having computer software and some components in the hardware which are physically reading the text and then converting it into the searchable text in the system itself. There are so many people who own the rights to these works across the United States. If you think about all the different authors and the different publishing companies out there, that no one individually seems to be able to afford to do this or to would have been able to develop the software on their own since it's so costly. A company like Google seems to be well suited to solve the problem.
I will say they have a lot of cool robots that automatically turn pages of books in order to get the scanning to work properly.
Yeah, and the other part of this, of course, if you make this, if you flip this agreement so that every author then has to opt into it to be part of the settlement, and then effectively the opt-in is like asking the authors to individually approve or grant authorization for Google to scan in the books, then you are sort of left without this whole range of orphan works which are out there.
And when we get to that, though, I think that's where Congress is a better solution than the courts, and this is what both you and the judge alluded to. You're asking a lot of a class that isn't, you know, there to represent themselves to, you know, basically sign over these rights to Google because they're not available to opt out. It seems like the better solution is to ask Congress to go back and revamp the rules regarding orphan works, rather than having a class action settlement be the way to do that.
It seems like the legislative fix, though, has its own problems, just because that's such a complicated process of figuring out the right way to amend the Copyright Act in a way that still respects the rights that have been granted to those orphan works under the Act when they were first created, and also gives a company like Google or whoever the, you know, whoever the right person might be, whether it's a government entity or not, to start scanning these books in and making them available. Because works disintegrate over time; they don't last forever. The physical containers in the real world are limited. We're talking about paper.
Right, but that's what Congress is good at. Congress is good at making these arbitrary rules based on research and lobbying and discussion. That's not what courts are good at. Courts are better at, you know, taking existing rules and, you know, applying them.
Likelihood, in your guys' opinions, that Congress will be able to come up with a solution to this sometime soon?
Zero.
Yeah, I don't think they're keen to do anything other than debate about the budget right now.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very unlikely that we will see a solution to this problem. Meanwhile, there has been other attempts, though, to try to figure out how or what might be a good way to scan these books in without infringing copyrights. And it's worth noting that the real problem is the scanning of the work itself. Well, I mean, there's two problems. There's the scanning and then the redistribution of it that Google has been doing. But the initial scan, when they get a copy, a physical copy of the book, and scan it in, that right there is your first infringement of copyright, because you're making another copy of the work. And then, of course, you're also potentially infringing it as you redistribute it. So you would need to be able to handle both of those, illegally at least, you would need to be able to defend yourself on both those fronts through a fair use defense. And it's possible that they could defend themselves well, I think, on the search indexing part of it. So if I run a search in Google and come up with a Google book, I'm not seeing the entire work. I'm just seeing snippets that seems to fit at least somewhat well. Probably it's not a square fit, but it's a fit nonetheless into the fair use doctrine. But that first scan of digitizing the book in the first place, and now that you have a physical copy and then a digital copy, is especially problematic since you're using the work as a whole, and then you have the even bigger issue that Google is also making money off of this because of their advertising.
Sort of a naive author's perspective. Why doesn't Google just get permission before scanning each book? And if authors don't want their work scanned.
It's not for lack of trying. there's this other problem out there. Even if you have authors who are known, and if you have authors that are known or don't necessarily have all the necessary rights to grant those permissions to Google, sometimes those rights get split, and this happens when there are contract agreements between an author and a publishing company, and the rights get divided in such a way that you would need to have authorization from both entities. And sometimes it's just unclear because, like I said before, you have publishing companies that dissolve over time, they go bankrupt and stuff. It's unclear who the actual rights owners are. Even if all the parties are sort of known, you would have to pay a lot of money to have teams of lawyers go back in and renegotiate and sort of collect all of those rights that have been spread out over time and make it all neat and pretty so that you can easily send a contract to Google and say, yes, it's okay for you to scan in my book.
Continuing with the naive author's perspective, so it's better for Google to just steal the book rather than do the necessary due diligence to ascertain authorship and ownership and acquire the rights?
It's better for Google to make the book available for people to search, see if it's what they're looking for, and then purchase, than it is for Google to just leave your book there undiscovered.
Do you guys ever use Google Books then to see if you'd be interested in buying a book?
I've occasionally used Google Books to find a quote that I wasn't sure if I was remembering correctly, but I've never used it to look at a book to see if I wanted to buy it first.
Yeah, mostly I use it to get quotes for books I've already read. If I want to look inside a book, I go to Amazon usually, because they have this look inside a book feature that's kind of nice.
How about you, David Liu?
Yeah, likewise. I mean, I've used it to find a couple of articles that our library does not necessarily have, and then possibly either request it if the entire thing is not available, or if it is available on Google Books. Sometimes that suits my purposes enough, at least just for a first pass breadth research kind of thing.
Yeah, same here too. I've used it to look up quotes and things along those lines to verify pages in books when I didn't have a physical copy handy of it, but I've never really used it to sort of preview a book before purchase. And nonetheless, I think there's a lot of value in having that, the ability to search a book's text and to specifically target a book and then search within the text, you know, the enormous value in that. It's so hard after spending so many years in like almost an entirely digital world, it's hard to go back to the physical book world and have to go through a book that's not well organized and go through chapter by chapter to find exactly what I'm looking for. Sometimes I just want to Google it, so to speak. Thank you. In terms of the next steps for Google, it seems that Google could continue to litigate the case, which seems very unlikely given all the time and money they've put into negotiating a settlement. They could, of course, now go back and amend the settlement and change the terms of it so that authors would have to give their individual permission before their books could be scanned in. It's also possible that Google could appeal the case, or also the other parties could appeal the case too. Again, unclear at this point how likely that might be. It would seem that they would go back to the settlement agreement and work on some of the problems that the judge identified. And of course, finally, as we already discussed, they could try to take this to Congress for a fix, but I don't personally see that as a quick resolution. You guys have anything else that you'd like to talk about?
So what's the status quo now that the judge handed this down? Like, what's the state right now?
It's pending some sort. It's kind of in limbo. There's no settlement that's been approved. So, I mean, it's either back to the drawing table for a settlement or back to, you know, discovery and motions to, you know, get some sort of damages.
At this point, they have the ability to go back and do all those options that I just mentioned. And it seems like one of the most likely that they'll probably do is go back and start looking at the settlement again to see where they might be able to remedy these problems. It's something that the EFF pointed out that the judge didn't seem to think was very much of a problem. And there were other consumer privacy watchdogs who had filed complaints in this area. Basically, is the privacy concerns that relate to Google having the power then to collect nearly unlimited data about the activities of users in the book search, in its book search services. you'd be able to see basically what people's search queries were, the books that people were reading, how long each reader was spending on a book, what pages they read in particular, and the judge didn't really seem to think that these were problems because Google had agreed to certain safeguards in the settlement agreement. Are those privacy concerns real? Google already has a lot of information about us that they get from our standard Google searches. Would a Google book search give them anything additionally that might be of a heightened concern?
I mean, there's always a concern with regard to somebody, particularly a governmental entity, being able to access what book somebody reads. You know, or should we be more concerned because it's Google and they already have all this other information? Yeah, you know, I really don't know. Google tends to be pretty good with, you know, being concerned with people's privacy and, you know, not disclosing stuff unnecessarily.
I mean, also, no one's forcing people to use Google Books, right?
Right.
No one's forcing anybody to use any of Google's services.
But this goes, so your comment, Dominic, actually goes back to the Department of Justice's concerns about antitrust issues, because per the terms of the settlement agreement, Google would effectively be the largest repository of scanned books. And they are pretty much the only one, because no other company to date has gone through something like this with all those rights owners. So any final thoughts before we wrap up? Obviously, this is a pretty complex story.
I'm all set for now, though we're going to have to keep an eye on it.
Also here.
Alrighty, well, on that note, I think we can wrap. Thanks again for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitko.
And I'm David Liu.
As usual, you can visit our website at technicallylegal.org. Check us out on Twitter at @techlegal and send us comments or stories that you'd like us to cover at podcast@technicallylegal.org. We'll see you again next week.